is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The author, Nick Loy, who is a reader of military and imperial history at King's College in London. His new book is The Western Front, A History of the Great War, Volume 1. There are two more to follow. This one is about the battlefront that we think of as trench warfare, the Great War at the time, called World War One now, 1914 to 1918. It begins with the German attack, and we've discussed these personalities. Now you can see the tension that they lived through in real time. There was a plan called the Schlieffen Plan to take Paris, and it was depending upon the right wing of the German army. The right wing. The left wing, the Germans have armies enough to deploy from Alsace-Lorraine to Verdun into the Marne Valley, the Marne River Valley, all the way to Paris, where they're going to punch through and swing around Paris and end the war. And then, Nick, we go to the crisis at the Marne, as you explicate, and I want to focus very carefully here, Moltke's decision to ask Kluck, commanding the right wing of the army, the first army. There are seven German armies, and Kluck commands the first, and he seems a very thorough commander, very well chosen. But Moltke decides in the course of the events of August into September that Kluck should not envelop Paris, and the French were preparing to defend Paris to the last man, including letting parts of the city burn or be destroyed with an artillery barrage. They were desperate, despairing, futile at this point if the Germans had entered Paris with the First Army. But Moltke orders him to inward wheel, as you identify it, not to attack southwest, but to attack southeast. The British are south of Kluck, retreating. So I want to start first with the British and then go to the Germans, why they did this, and then go to the French. Sir John French, commanding the British Expeditionary Force, as you've identified, has four divisions and a cavalry division. Allenby, I believe, is in charge of his cavalry. They're falling back for days. And one of the men falling back was the man who will command the British forces in the Second War, Montgomery. So it's wonderful to see Montgomery experiencing the defeat of war. Kitchener gets a note from French that he's going to continue to keep falling back. And I think this is one of the most riveting scenes in your whole story, Nick, and it was very quick. Kitchener jumps on a destroyer, charges across the English Channel, races to the headquarters of the BEF. And what does he tell French? And what does French believe Kitchener's up to?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. This is one of those great scenes where, you know, the British Expeditionary Force have been surprised at Mons and Le Cateau, and, you know, basically they don't really know where the Germans are. They're on the French left, which is obviously on the northern sector, which is slap bang in the path of the Schlieffen Plan, of that swinging door. So the British get overwhelmed quite well. They get nearly overwhelmed a couple of times, and they're in retreat. This is late August 1914. And French is just horrified at this. He just sees these men retreating and he loses his nerve. He thinks this is insane. You know, what are we doing here? Where are the French? You know, this is not in the plan. We were just supposed to sort of tidy up the flank and make sure that, you know, to keep the French encouraged. And all of a sudden now he's facing the entire might of the German army. Remember, the First Army, von Kluck's First German Army, is over 300,000 men strong. It's absolutely enormous. The British are about 100,000. And so there's a possibility that the entire British Expeditionary Force can be destroyed in detail in August 1914. It's absolutely horrifying. And so French wires Kitchener and says, look, I'm going to essentially retreat and go for a break. We're going to sort of essentially get out of the line and refit. We need to refit. And, of course, Kitchener is horrified at this, because if the British do this, essentially abandoning the French, then this is, you know, politically and strategically very, very bad, potentially could cause the alliance to shatter, like you see in 1940. So Kitchener comes and basically, we don't exactly know what happens at the meeting. No minutes were recorded, but we can piece it together. And Kitchener essentially orders French to stay in the line and do what he can. And of course, French finds this quite humiliating. He thinks Kitchener just doesn't understand what he's going through. And it sets the scene for poor relations between the two of those, you know, for the next year. And again, it's an indication, which is one of the themes of the book, of the stresses and strains of war. This war is far bigger, far more dangerous, far more bloody than anyone had expected. And for a small army like the British, you cannot lose that many casualties, because if you do, the British simply do not have another army to replace it with. The French have a big army. They have lots of people who are trained. And so if you lose one army, you have five of them, then that's obviously terrible, but you can continue. If the British lose the expeditionary force, they cannot be replaced, or they can't be replaced quickly. So again, this is the kind of pressure that people like French are under.
Why did Moltke order Kluck to move from attacking southwest to envelop Paris to attacking southeast? Why did he do that?
Well, this is one of the great controversies, certainly in the German literature, of the 1914 campaign. Generations of historians and soldiers have looked at first, you know, how the Schlieffen plan fails, and they try to work out where it went wrong and how and whether it could have succeeded. And ultimately what happens is Kluck is supposed to lead that whole swinging door around Paris. Very quickly, they make an idea that they understand that they can't do it. They just don't have the manpower. They're getting stretched. And so they decide to essentially pass through the, you know, pass east of Paris. And Moltke is okay with this. What Moltke eventually does several days later, he orders von Kluck to stop. So this goes against the central tenet of the Schlieffen plan, which von Kluck has, you know, he understands very well that the first army, his sort of extended flank, will continue until it slams the door shut on the French army. But of course, as the campaign goes on, Moltke is worried about the flank becoming more and more open. And so essentially he orders von Kluck to stop, and then von Kluck essentially ignores him. So essentially what happens is you have a complete collapse of command and control in the German army. German armies are just too big for an individual like Moltke to command. He's in Luxembourg. He is miles away. And they just can't get everyone they need to go in the right places. And I think that's one of the big problems with 1914, because although they use the railways to get them to their deployment areas, once they step off that railway station, German soldiers walk. They will walk. By the time they get to the Marne, von Kluck's men have gone, you know, hundreds of miles, and they're absolutely exhausted. So again, we can talk about the Marne and why the Germans don't win. I think it's a combination of factors. But of course, the blame game, was it Kluck? Was Kluck right? Was von Moltke, you know, wrong? This goes on after the war. And I think just, you know, to tie it up, my view, I think it's difficult for the Germans to win in 1914. Perhaps they could have done some things differently. But I do think it was a mistake perhaps not to go into Paris, because Paris has a sort of symbolic significance that's obviously very important.
Right.
So the other factor is, of course, most of French industry, Peugeot, Creusot, all those big industrial factories are in and around Paris. So if the Germans hold them, or at least destroy them, France can't continue the war.
You have a scene with Joffre. He's at Chateau Marmont. He has a conversation. He's given the order to die on the spot. He has a conversation, and he looks outside the window. He looks outside the window. It's a scene that it's art. That's what it is, Nick. I mean, it's as if Joffre knew we'd be talking about him 100 years later. The quote you give is, "Now heaven will decide." That was his personality. He did everything he could, and then he said, "Heaven decides." Was he lucky?
Yeah.
Was he lucky?
Yeah.
Is that it?
No, I don't think he was. I think the scene that you're mentioning is, it's recorded by one of the liaison officers who meets Joffre, one of the French liaison officers. And I found it, you know, quite moving, actually, because essentially what happens is Joffre doesn't think the Germans are going to move that much men through Belgium. He doesn't think they have the numbers. But when his forces are not able to react to that. So what happens as it becomes apparent that the Germans are massing huge numbers of troops to the north, he has to react and he has to move rapidly north. He has to move a lot of forces from his right to his left. And he does that. He shuttles the manpower through Paris. And then on the evening of the 5th of September, he orders the armies, which have been in full retreat for over a week now, he orders them to stand and, if necessary, die on the spot and then counterattack. This will become the Battle of the Marne, which destroys the Schlieffen plan. And I think it alludes to the point I made earlier about Joffre. He has that gravity, he has the nerve, and he has the sort of groundedness, I think, to say, you know what? I've done what I can. We're in position. We can outflank von Kluck. We can get round his back. All the armies can then march forward together to counterattack. And they counterattack on the Marne, which is one of the great battles of the 20th century. And that's, you know, Joffre is the man that manages that. And it would have been very easy for him to lose in 1914 if he'd lost his head, if he'd have confused his deployments. But he doesn't. He trusts in God. He gets it right on the battlefield. He counterattacks. He fights the Germans to a standstill. And then the 9th of September, after 3 days of heavy, heavy fighting, terrible casualties, the Germans retreat. Yeah. So they retreat back from the Marne. And they set up positions on the Aisne River. And that's the start of trench warfare.
That is the beginning.
So the Germans fail in 1914. Yeah, and that is because of Joffre's plan and the Battle of the Marne. So the stakes don't get any higher than that.
We're going to go to September 1915, the Second Battle of Champagne, because it will become clear in this battle that there is no winning. The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
My brother-in-law died suddenly, and now my sister and her kids have to sell their home. That's why I told my husband we could not put off getting life insurance any longer. An agent offered us a 10-year, $500,000 policy for nearly $50 a month. Then we called SelectQuote. SelectQuote found us identical coverage for only $19 a month, a savings of $369 a year.
Whether you need a $500,000 policy or a $5 million policy, SelectQuote could save you more than 50% on term life insurance.
For your free quote, go to SelectQuote.com. SelectQuote.com. That's SelectQuote.com.
SelectQuote. We shop, you save. Full details on example policies at SelectQuote.com/commercials.
Advanced Urology Centers of New York is the largest urology group practice in the U.S., with more than 45 locations in the New York area. With our expanded services and clinical affiliation with nationally renowned Mount Sinai Hospital, we're available to meet all your urological needs from the routine to the most complex. To learn more, call 855-DR-URology or visit AUCOFNY.com. That's 855-DR-URology or AUCOFNY.com.